got within probably an arm's length of my mate Nick, and the shark come up behind me and pulled me under for the second time, and it dragged me underwater for what felt like forever. I mean, I remember having to hold my breath. We completely disappeared. So my board and everything, I don't know how far down we were, but it sort of violently shook me until it ripped my leg off. And instantly, you know, I was amputated above the knee and losing lots of blood. And that's when I started to go out of it.
G'day, I'm Richard Harris, and thanks for joining me on Real Risk, the adventure podcast.
G'day, welcome, and thanks very much for joining me for the very last episode of season 2 of Real Risk. And what a blast it's been. This has been a fabulous season to be part of. I've very much enjoyed all the guests so far, from starting with our psychologist, Bill von Hippel, through amazing sailors, circumnavigators, cave divers, racing car drivers, of course, the amazing Mountain Month with Jimmy Chin and James Scott and Alex Honnold, and finishing up with our ocean adventurers of Maya Gabera, the incredible surfer, of course, Chris Lemons, whose podcast has been a huge hit with lots of very positive feedback, and finishing today with an extraordinarily nice young man who in 2015 was the subject of a shark attack in South Australia from a great white shark. Chris Blows is now an amputee who lives with a prosthetic leg and is about to publish his book describing the experience, which is called Caught Inside. Chris and his beautiful wife, Chloe, were kind enough to come to my house and tell me the story, which is the subject of today's episode. It was very interesting to see Chris again. I'd met him once when he came to talk to a group of us at MedStar, the South Australian Aeromedical Retrieval Service. MedStar was involved in part of the treatment and care of Chris after his attack, and I remember at the time thinking what an extraordinary recovery and, in fact, survival that he had made from against almost impossible odds when he basically bled out after the shark attack. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Chris to tell his story, and I look forward to seeing you all again for the next season of Real Risk, probably a couple of months break now, but then we'll be back with even more amazing guests. So thank you very much, and thanks again to our fabulous sponsor, Bremont, who have been extraordinarily supportive during this season. Cheerio.
G'day, Chris. Thanks very much for joining me.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Harry.
Chris, you're a well-known surfer who suffered a shark attack 5 years ago, and that's what we're here to talk about. But you've spent a bit of time on the West Coast, which is one of my favourite parts of the world, the West Coast of South Australia. When I was about 12 years old, I started going over to Coffin Bay with my family and exploring the fishing and diving opportunities over there. Did you grow up on the West Coast?
No, I actually grew up in Woodside in the Adelaide Hills. Had a pretty ordinary childhood, you know, typical. Grew up playing lots of cricket, footy, loved my skating. Didn't really get into surfing until I was about 16, but that was just from we used to have a Christmas stay down at Port Elliot and slowly got into it. And then as soon as I started, and I was addicted straight away.
Yeah, I love the sensation of surfing. I took it up very late in life when I was about 29. I had an early midlife crisis, thought, what have I been doing? It looks so good. I've got to give this a go. And I think that at that stage of life, trying to adapt to something new like surfing, particularly if you're a bit uncoordinated like I am, was all a bit desperate. So I found myself, you know, to be pretty bad at it, to be honest.
It's definitely not something easy, and especially down the south coast at Middleton, it's generally that's where I learned to surf, but it's a pretty big paddle out the back, and I'd say it's not the greatest spot to learn to surf, and a lot of people that I've taken to teach how to surf generally don't last too long, so I think you really got to want to do it.
Yeah, and starting at 16, well, probably starting at 10 is even better, but starting at 16 is great, the way to go. So when did you get pretty serious straight away? Were you riding?
I was going down sort of every weekend when I could. Once, you know, when I was 16, I obviously had my license and I was able to do that, and then as I got into it more, I started to do trips over to the York Peninsula, and that's when I really fell in love with it. There's a lot better waves over there, and, the better the waves get, the more addicted you get to it. And then, I was hooked after that.
So my surfy friends always talked about places like Cactus and Elliston as the places to go if you're really Hardcore? So did you start to get
done a few
there?
Trips to Cactus? We used to do one every March long weekend, and that's generally the best time to go there. You know, light winds and plenty of swell, and they're some of the best memories I have of surfing. I've been all over the world, like in Europe, and done some Indonesian surf trips, North Sumatra, and I still think some of the best waves I've had have been on the Eyre Peninsula.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It is a beautiful part of the world.
It is, yeah.
So you've never lived over there? You've always just travelled from Adelaide?
Yeah, me and Chloe. So Chloe actually, my wife got a teaching job over there in 2011, I think it might have been. And I followed her over there. She was teaching in a country town, Cummins, in Central Eyre Peninsula. And I moved over there shortly after and worked for a local builder over there as a carpenter. And, yeah, we fell in love with the place straight away. Just so many nice untouched beaches and great fishing, great surfing. But, yeah, obviously very sharky.
Yeah. And so you were living in Cummins for a while?
We lived in Port Lincoln and Chloe used to drive up to work every day. But I played footy and stuff like that in Cummins. So.
Now, I know a little bit about football over on the Eyre Peninsula because I had good friends in Wongaree. I was definitely a Wongaree football club man, Marble Range. Shout out to the boys at the club there. I've had many entertaining evenings over at that place.
Yeah, they love their footy over there. There's so many different leagues as well. I just can't get over how many teams and different leagues there is for a country area. They managed to still get all the players out. So
who did you play for?
I played for Ramblers Football Club. Mm-hmm. There's two teams in Cummins, Ramblers and Cougars. Yeah, Cougars. Yeah. Almost forgot. But, yeah, I played for Ramblers. I played in an A-grade premiership, but I broke my leg in the last 2 minutes, I reckon, of the grand final. And that's when I decided I'd give up football and just surf because I thought that'd be much safer. And then that turned out not to be, but
yeah. Which leg did you break?
I broke my right leg, which is, yeah.
Right.
They could have taken that one, but I've done pretty much every injury there is. So,
yeah,
I think I'd done an injury on my left leg and I was only, that was one of my first surfs back from my injury on my left leg and then ended up losing it.
Mm. So, let's talk about that day then. So, that was while you were living on the West Coast?
Yep. So, it was Anzac Day 2015 and Chloe had gone over to Adelaide for a music festival. And so I had a couple of mates around the night before, stuck into a few beers, got up early, went to dawn service, and then decided to go for a surf to a local spot about 20 minutes drive, half hour drive, called Fishery Bay. Generally, the closest surf spot to Port Lincoln and, you know, on a spot I was surfing called Wright Point is generally the only spot you can surf when it's big and stormy and blowing southwest winds. And I'd probably been surfing for, I reckon, an hour. And I was paddling back out when I got hit from behind. What felt like being hit by a car at the time, but soon realized I was being attacked by a big great white shark. Instantly I thought, far out, this thing's strong, you know, like had me in its mouth and shook me around for a bit. It had the underside of my board and the top part of its jaw was over my hip and it sort of shook me around for a little bit before letting go. And this stage I was off my board and everyone heard me scream and someone yelled shark. So everyone scrambled for the rocks, including my two mates I was surfing with. I don't think they realized who it was to start off with, but once they'd realized who it was, they both turned around and started the paddle back out towards me. Well, I was obviously in a fair bit of shock and, you know, I thought that first thing that came to my mind was, oh no, this is it, you know, pretty much, you know, this could be it. I'm going to die. And I was starting the paddle towards my two mates who were also paddling back out to me. I got within probably an arm's length of my mate Nick and the shark. Nick went to reach out for me and the shark come up behind me and pulled me under for the second time. This time I was off my board, so it had my left leg and it dragged me underwater for what felt like forever. I mean, I remember having to hold my breath. And once it, you know, we completely disappeared. So my board and everything were, I don't know how far down we were, but it sort of violently shook me until it ripped my leg off. And instantly, you know, I was amputated above above the knee and losing lots of blood. And that's when I started to go out of it. Yeah, so I obviously losing blood pretty quick. And I was already going in and out of consciousness straight away. Then once I'd resurfaced, my two mates, Nick and Brock, were still sitting around me there. I'd popped up out of nowhere and they were virtually just swimming around in my blood. And they tried to get on either side of me, I got on Nick's back and we got hit by a wave and we got separated again. Once I resurfaced again after that, they got on either side of me and they virtually just frog-leaped me to the shore, and where another surfer already had his leg rope off his board and they tied that around my stump, and that pretty well stopped the blood. The only blood I had left in me pretty well straight away, and that did a really good job. That stayed on until I got to hospital.
Surfers seem to know the trick of the leg.
Yeah, it's just, just little things that day. If they didn't have that tourniquet on, if they didn't have that leg rope around my leg straight away, it could have been a few more, even a minute, I could have bled to death. And, yeah, that was definitely a vital part.
So that point from the second attack when you were pulled underwater, is that where things start to get a bit hazy?
Yeah, definitely. So as soon as my leg, I must have lost so much blood just in that initial amputation. That's when things start to get a bit hazy with memory. And at this point, we were down the bottom. Once I'd got into shore, we're still down the bottom of a cliff. And trying to explain what Bright Point's like, I mean, it's in front of a cliff face and there's about probably 100 sets of stairs to get up to the over. And I was right down the bottom half of the point. So we still had all these sharp rocks to get over and then up this flight of stairs and then into a car that someone had parked up there. But, you struggle to walk across those rocks by yourself and not hurt yourself. How they got me onto a surfboard and stretching me over those rocks and then up those stairs.
Just two guys.
Well, no, there would have been probably 10, 15 guys out in the water. So by the time we'd got to shore, they virtually just relayed me over the rocks. There would have been 10 guys doing it, stretching me on a cliff and up the stairs. And then they threw me into the back of Nick's car, who someone had already reversed up, ready to go. Once I got into the car, I don't really remember too much of that car ride. I think I was pretty well gone there. I don't remember we met up with the ambulance, a couple of Ks down the road, but I don't remember that. I think my heart had completely stopped by that stage.
Just to go back to the bit in the water a bit again, do you recall what level of fear you were experiencing? I mean, were you terrified?
Oh, yeah, I think, and one of the other guys, Surfers Joe, he was walking up the stairs looking the other way when I was attacked, and when he heard me scream, it wasn't a scream of it was like a scream of serious terror, and it wasn't just it was a screech sort of, sound good. And that obviously showed how much the fear that I had at that time, and literally all those things, those thoughts come straight to your head when you're getting attacked by sharkers,
And what do you remember about the power of the thing?
Oh, it was unbelievable. And when I hear those stories about people being able to turn around and punch the shark, I don't know how. It's so smart and it was so strong and it knew exactly what it was doing, Once it let go of me the first time, it virtually turned, Joe described it, he's never seen something so big turn 180 and come back at me. It was in control the whole time.
Mm. Anyone have a feel for how big it was?
Some people were saying around 6 meters, but we reckon about 4.5, 5 meters, which is still a very big shark.
Yeah, having seen a 4.5 meter white shark underwater from the safety of a cage, the girth on the things just becomes so big when they get over that 4 meter size.
Yeah.
They're just like trucks.
Yeah, and all the boys described that, the thing was huge, and when it pulled me under the second time, they got sucked, Nick and Brock got sucked into it, as if when something sinks, and they could feel it around them, but they couldn't see where it was.
And what about pain? Do you remember pain being a thing?
That's an interesting thing as well. I didn't have any pain at all when it was happening. I couldn't breathe. I don't know what that was, whether it was a blood loss or shock, but I just could not get a breath in. But there was no pain. I didn't have any pain until I woke up in hospital. and after my surgery and stuff like that.
Well, it's comforting for people who might be.
Yeah, I did say that too. There's this a group called Bite Club, which is a support group for shark attack survivors and people that have been involved or witnessed or whatever. And I've explained to some of those guys that have lost their son or something in a shark attack that it's not a painful experience. You're in that much shock and it happens so quick that I can think of – sounds bad, but I can think of worse ways to die. Yeah, yeah. Dying of cancer or something like that would be much worse.
For sure, yeah. What do your mates say about the day from their point of view? I mean, was it horrific and frightening for them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing that it's not just me. It's been everyone that witnessed that day has been through some kind of trauma, and especially Nick and Brock. It's definitely affected them in a big way mentally. But I think the best thing for them seeing me get back into surfing has helped their recovery heaps.
Yeah. Are they surfing again?
They are, yeah. Good. Yeah, they still surf. They still love it as much as I do. And, yeah, it's been the best thing for all of us.
Awesome. Yeah. All right, so we're up on the beach and somehow they carried you up the stairs the same way as they got you across the rocks on the board.
Yeah, I was in the car and once I got into the car, into the ambulance, and obviously once I was in the ambulance, they had to administer CPR like I had no pulse. I was very lucky that day that there was two paramedics and one paramedic that was driving. So there was two paramedics were able to work on me in the back of the ambulance while I was on my way to hospital, which I don't think if there was one paramedic, whether I would have survived. Just for little things, you'd probably know about the story that how they were able to, they put an IV drip into me and that kept whatever little blood I had in my body flowing through. And I know that they're not allowed to, they don't administer CPR while in transport, but they decided to do that day just because they had to get me to hospital.
Yeah, people might not appreciate the importance of what you just said about having two paramedics in the back of the ambulance while you're driving because, yep. You know, for a single person to be putting an IV in, doing CPR and giving you oxygen through a bag and mask is literally impossible. So
yep.
They would have had to stop and both work on you and wait for the outcome to declare itself, and obviously that would have been a terminal event. So, yeah, as you say, there's a lot of things that just fell in your favour after a really bad bit of luck at the start of the day.
Yep.
Things kind of lined up for you after that.
Yeah, and, yeah, obviously they'd firstly administered CPR that whole half an hour ambulance ride till I got to hospital, and then on and off for the next 45, 50 minutes until I'd shown any signs of life. So it blows me away how I survived it and how I've come away with no brain damage.
Was that a dirt road from Fishery Bay?
Dirt road, yeah. Well, for the first few Ks, then it once you get closer to Port Lincoln, it's bitumized and, yeah. Definitely not a flat road, that's for sure. And there's definitely it was quite wet that day. Definitely lots of potholes, and it was quite slippery too. So,
did your mates have to do any CPR or anything in the back of the car?
No, they didn't. I think they're glad they didn't have to. Yeah, but no, they didn't have to do any CPR. I think my heart had just stopped just as the ambulance got there.
So we're driving in the ambulance back to Port Lincoln Hospital. Port Lincoln's a town of about 30,000 people, 20,000 people. 16? Okay. So it's not, you know, we're not talking major regional centre full of intensive care doctors.
And that's it. And they would have never seen anything like that come in. And the fact that how well they, you know, a small town, small country hospital, what they did that day on me is incredible. And, yeah, they should be praised for that because, they definitely did all the hard work and saved my life before I even got to Royal Adelaide Hospital.
Yeah, for sure. Now, the GP on that day, a lady called Michelle, I think, was sort of flying in, flying out of Port Lincoln, and she literally arrived
at
the hospital for the start of her shift
kind of
around the same time as you did. So have you spoken to her at all about what her impressions of that
Yeah, I mean, she walked into a war zone. I wasn't the only person that was injured. There was some bike riders that got hit by a car. And they were in a bad way also, but they virtually got told to sit in the waiting room and because they had no option. And I think there was probably 14 people working on me in that room. So, yeah, everything got put on hold.
So the resuscitation, obviously, you know, putting my doctor hat on, I can imagine it would have revolved around, you know, looking after your airway and your breathing and trying to restore some blood volume with some blood from the blood bank. They would have been throwing everything at you that
they So they, I can't remember how many units of blood. I think it might have been 6 or 7 units of blood. They managed to stop the blood coming from my stump, but my first bite mark on my hip, that was causing some issues. So they had to someone there trying to stitch up a few things, but doing what they could. They had a doctor there working my airways, and then virtually paramedics. There was police. There was, they were all taking turns of, on top of me doing CPR for that 50 minutes or whatever. Just why it was chaos. Yeah, I just don't know how I survived it.
No, we'll come to that, and that's you know, that is one of the big questions about this whole incident. And last week I interviewed Chris Lemons, who's a saturation diver who had his umbilical severed while they were diving at 90 metres in the North Sea and was without any kind of oxygen and unconscious for over 35 minutes.
Wow.
And he, like yourself, has recovered completely intact. And
That's crazy.
And it also is completely inexplicable. No one can really understand how he survived that thing.
So, yeah.
You know, it fascinates me how people sometimes, and not usually, but occasionally survive injuries or illnesses that no medical professional can predict that they would, you know, survive.
Yeah.
And just goes, I mean, it's a really important reminder for everyone working in the healthcare system that, you know, you've got to treat everyone on their own count and not just treat them like a statistic. And you might say, look, 99% of people are not going to survive this, but 1% of them do.
Yeah.
And we have to assume this is the 1%er.
Yeah, absolutely. And it probably changes a lot of people's perspective on, you know, how long you can do CPR for and all those things. Doing CPR, you know, while being under transport in an ambulance, stuff like that, you're not meant to do. All those little things that they probably revisited and reviewed.
Yeah, and that, of course, for the listeners, is a work health and safety issue for the paramedics, you know. Standing unrestrained in the back of a ambulance traveling with its lights and sirens on is, you know, not really a safe practice.
You
have to swerve a little bit and the ambulance goes over on a dirt road and then you've got
you're in trouble,
four
yeah.
casualties instead of one. So, you know, a lot of stuff gets thought about during these cases, which, you know, on any other day they might have said, well, you know, that's too risky, or a different group of paramedics might not have done it. They might have followed the rules perhaps and, again, you wouldn't be here today. So, might just go to Kylie Stanton at the moment, who was involved. Dr. Kylie Stanton's a medical retrieval consultant at MedStar, which is part of the South Australian Ambulance Service, and Kylie was on duty that day.
Welcome, Kylie.
Thank you, Harry.
So your role at the ambulance service with the organisation called MedStar, could you just tell me what that involves?
So I'm a retrieval consultant there. I'm also an anaesthetist in my other time. What that involves is some clinical time where we're paired up with a nurse or paramedic and we go out and do cases, either primary cases such as car accidents and things, or we go to hospitals in the country and pick up sick people and bring them back. And about a third of the time we coordinate that job. So we coordinate the clinical teams that are out doing those clinical jobs.
So you're based in the operations centre, I understand, and calls come in and you'll allocate resources as appropriate to those jobs?
That's correct.
Do you remember the day that you got the call about Chris Blows and how that unfolded?
I certainly do. It was Anzac Day 2015, and it was Anzac Day is normally a fairly significant day for myself as well as a lot of my friends. We normally participate in that. I was also fairly new to the coordinating job at that stage. It was only my second or third solo shift, and all the normal people that I would call for advice were marching in Anzac Day. And I was sitting in the communications centre, and I heard behind me someone say that there had been a shark attack in Port Lincoln, and someone had lost their leg. Was the first I heard of it. And that was referred across to me. The normal procedure when someone's hurt in South Australia, we have what's called a rapid response zone, which is a circle around Adelaide. And if it's within this zone, we'll very quickly send a helicopter to a significant incident like that. Chris's accident or incident was way outside that. It was a long way away and not one where we would normally automatically send a response. We would normally wait to see what evolved when resources got there. That particular day, I don't know, I just had a feeling. I thought whoever this has happened to is going to be most likely young and fit and they deserve a go. So I immediately tasked a team on the helicopter.
And outside that rapid response zone, does that mean the helicopter has to stop and refuel or what's the go with that?
Sometimes. Outside that zone, a lot of the time we would send a fixed-wing aircraft. That takes at least 45 minutes to get off the ground, and that wasn't really an option in this case. Past a certain distance, yes, the helicopter does have to refuel. I knew that it could get to Port Lincoln in one go.
Did you have any clinical information by this stage, or that was literally that description, man versus shark at that point?
That was it. That was it.
So these are very difficult decisions, I guess, and obviously I'm speaking somewhat from experience because I've worked in the same role with Kylie and know what's involved. But for the people who are out there thinking, well, why wouldn't you send something like this? What are the factors that go through your mind?
There's various factors. So there's resource factors from our point of view. There's time factors, and there's also likely outcome factors from what you're dealing with. So we only have limited resources. We only generally have two adult teams on at one time. So if I send a resource a long way away in a helicopter, we only have two of those as well, then I don't have that for many hours. So the time factor is also a thing. Also with a case like this, shark versus human doesn't normally end that well. And to send a resource for a long time without any further information is unusual.
How long did it take to get some clinical information from the scene or from bystanders or who did you even speak to first?
It wasn't that long. So the helicopter was only just airborne, so it was probably 10, 15 minutes after that initial call that I then got some more information, which didn't excite me a lot, was that the patient was under CPR. So at that stage, on any ordinary day, I would probably have turned the helicopter around. So they were still a long way away from Port Lincoln, and the likelihood I was thinking in my mind of someone surviving from blood loss when they'd gone into a state of cardiac arrest was about zero. But then I had this thought in my mind that my initial thought was young and fit. This person's not dead until they've got to hospital and they're warm and they're full of blood and they're dead.
Mm.
So let's keep going.
So the patient's a long way from Port Lincoln, the helicopter's still a long way from Port Lincoln, and you've just got this news that the patient's getting CPR and in the framework of or in the context of blood loss, that's usually associated with a pretty bad outcome.
Yeah, yeah. And I did some more research about it afterwards and it's pretty much zero. Obviously not. In Chris's case, it's somewhere between 0 and 1%, but it's really low.
So this is a part of the story that Chris won't be able to tell for himself, obviously. He's receiving CPR. He's obviously unconscious. What did you find out after that? What happened over the time that Chris was underway to hospital?
From my point of view, I was then trying to get in touch with Port Lincoln Hospital and give them a heads up and get some resources underway and into the ED department there so that they were right ready to go when he arrived. And that was mainly blood products and also giving them a heads up that this was coming in. I didn't get a lot more information from the scene. I did get a bit through the ambulance officers that they were intermittently doing CPR and then they'd get some output back and some signs of life and then that would disappear and they'd continue CPR. So it was a bit of a roller coaster getting Chris back to the hospital.
When did the helicopter arrive in Port Lincoln compared to when Chris arrived in Port Lincoln?
Chris arrived in Port Lincoln and I got a call from the local doctor that was on that day, who'd actually arrived late. The plane that she was coming on to do that shift was late and she'd only just arrived in the department. And I got a call from her after Chris had arrived and they'd started resuscitation and pretty much stayed on the phone chatting to her and listening to what was going on for the next 45 minutes or an hour until the helicopter arrived. It had to land on the oval, stop the local footy match, and the team then get to the hospital.
And was CPR still going when Chris got to the hospital, do you know?
Yes, yes. So that continued and cycled in and out. And it was a bit of a cycle again of some signs of life, and then they'd lose signs of life and start CPR again. And that all up from when the accident happened to when CPR ceased was about an hour and a half.
Wow.
So it was a long time.
And were they still doing CPR when the team arrived from Adelaide?
No, but not long before then they'd stopped. So they'd managed to get some control of the bleeding by then, fill him up with some blood and some other blood products and stabilise a little.
Mm. So what was the transfer like for the team? Was it fairly chaotic for them?
Yeah, it took them a little while to get him ready to go as far as to maintain control of bleeding from the leg that he'd lost. And then to get him onto the helicopter and fly back, I think they were not long out of the Royal Adelaide Hospital back in Adelaide when things started to go a little pear-shaped again, and he'd obviously resumed bleeding. So they were met on the roof where the helicopter lands with some extra blood and then took him down to the emergency department there.
Do you know if he suffered another cardiac arrest during the transfer or subsequently?
No, I don't think so.
No, okay. With the retrospectoscope, looking back at this, obviously it was very fortunate that you sent the helicopter when you did, kind of despite the gut instinct or the medical instincts and the evidence to suggest that it was almost a futile position to take to send a resource like that to someone who's in cardiac arrest because of blood loss and trauma. And as you say, the chances of a good outcome from that seem infinitesimally low statistically. But there's always someone who's the outlier, isn't there? And the person who's at the wrong end of the bell-shaped curve, or the right end in this case.
That's true. Having now done this job for 5 or 6 years, I don't know whether I would send the helicopter again, having seen what I've seen in the meantime. That particular day, I had an instinct that I needed to do that, and a lot of things lined up for Chris that day.
Well, I think, you know, we try and be scientific about as much of what we do as possible, but a lot of what we do is driven by previous experience and by that gut feeling, which often makes us either good or bad clinicians, I guess. And you proved yourself to be a champion that day, Kylie, and I bet Mr. Blows is pretty happy with the path you took.
I'm fairly happy with the path that we all took that day. It's certainly a significant event that's occurred in my career, and it's been a pleasure to meet Chris and Chloe since then, and to see him doing well.
Thanks, Kylie.
Hello, this is Giles English, the co-founder of Bremel Watch Company. We're proud to be supporting Dr. Harris with the show, an ambassador and a friend of the brand who symbolises the core of Bremel with its tested beyond endurance motto. As an engineering company, we specialise in the manufacturing of beautifully made mechanical aviation watches that are built to be worn in the boardroom or at Mount Everest. With our strong military links, we work with adventurers all over the world. Now, to learn more, please go to bremel.com and read about the likes of NIMS, who's just smashed the record for climbing the 14 highest peaks in under 7 months, and see the watch he's wearing. Well, thank you for listening and hope you enjoy the show.
So, yeah, interesting chatting with Kylie Stanton, who you wouldn't have known anything about on the day of your injury, but was, like so many people, working away in the background to organise the transport and care of you from Port Lincoln to Adelaide. I guess from the time that you lost consciousness in the ambulance, you wouldn't remember any of this, of course. So what's your first recollection after the accident?
would be waking up in ICU. Would have been almost 10 days after my attack. I was still very confused. I don't remember being attacked by a shark. And I was under lots of pain medication. So I was still very confused until I'd been awake for probably 2 days, and everyone was able to retell me the story and explain to me, and yeah, it just slowly came back to me. But those first few days waking up from ICU were very confusing. I didn't really know where I was, and lots of people came in and spoke to me that in that time, and yeah, I don't really remember any of it.
Do you think your recollections of the events, you know, did come back to you, or is it hard to distinguish the real memories from the stuff you were told?
They definitely did. Yeah, it was weird because I was slipping into dreams from all the pain meds as well about different stuff. So when I was waking, I was very confused. I thought I'd lost my leg under an excavator or something like that. Yeah, so a couple of weeks down the track, once I wasn't on as much pain medication, I was able to, I don't know how it happens, but yeah, I do bring back the pieces and yeah.
It's interesting. I'm just thinking back to what you said about not feeling any pain during the attack. Just reflecting on something the saturation diver, Chris, also said was that, you know, he was in full fight and flight response like you were when the umbilical got severed and he realized that he had 8 minutes of gas left from that point, the tanks on his back.
Yeah.
And he was diving in 4-degree water in the North Sea. And when the umbilical broke, of course, his hot water supply to his suit also stopped that instant. So he would have been basically like dunked in a bath of 4-degree water from having sort of 30-degree water washing around him.
Yeah.
And he has no recollection of discomfort or cold.
Yeah.
In that time that it took for him to lose consciousness. And I wonder, you know, when the adrenaline is really surging through your body and you're fighting for your life, you can really only concentrate on one thing that's a life threat or even uncomfortable at that moment in time. And for you, I mean, it's a blessing really that you felt no pain and he felt no cold, which would have been horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, don't get me wrong, the pain definitely started in hospital, and it was, you know, I've broken my leg, I've broken both my arms, done my knee. So I've had a bit of pain, but the pain that I had from my leg was undescribable. It was 10 out of 10 pain. Pain was so bad one night they had to come in and try and give me a nerve block, I think it is, So I was sort of numb from my waist down, but they couldn't find it. I eventually fell asleep after – you know, loading up with pain drugs, but yeah, it was unbelievably bad. Yeah, it's something I definitely do not wish upon anyone.
No, was that that nerve pain from the missing limb, or was it the stump?
Just general stump pain, I think. And the swelling and all that just got too much. The nerve pain didn't start till I'd got home, and yeah, obviously that's when the phantom limb pain starts, and that's a pain in your. Especially a pain in your leg that's not there anymore. So I'd get these every night, you know, crippling electric shocks in your big toe. You can literally pinpoint where it is. And that stops after about 12 months. It sort of slowly gets better, but I still have the odd night where I don't get any sleep, you know, maybe once a month where I just get electric shocks all night. But yeah, can be absolutely crippling.
Do you know if you went to the operating theatre more than once while you're in intensive care? You would have had a few visits.
Yeah, so I had my initial sewing up of my hip wounds and around my bum when I first got into Royal Adelaide Hospital, and also my hand. So I must have pushed the shark, or when I went to go push the shark away, your natural reflex, I severed my little finger, and that was sort of just hanging on. And, you know, that was only a small surgery. I think it went for 6 hours. Redoing all that, and then they didn't close the end of my stump until 2 weeks after my attack, and that was just because I was too unstable.
Yeah,
I was under renal failure because of the amount of CPR that I had had, and all my organs had virtually shut down at that time. So I was going in and out of dialysis, and in their opinion, I was too unstable to put me under those first 2 weeks. When they did do my surgery, they gave me a nerve block, as I said before. So I was awake for the surgery, just numb from my waist down, and that's, yeah,
God bless anaesthetists. Yeah. He says, as an anaesthetist. So, yeah, I mean, the whole event took its toll on your body, and it was obviously
a
fair while before you're out of the woods.
Yeah. So, you know, I had high blood pressure for 6 months just because my kidneys and liver and that weren't working properly. I was able to stop dialysis in hospital, but, there was still a few issues that I had to deal with after hospital. I've slowly got on top of them, but it definitely hasn't been smooth sailing. You know, rehab was a slow process, very frustrating process. I wasn't allowed to wear a prosthetic for quite some time. Because of my renal failure, I swelled up in those first couple of weeks and all my wounds opened up, all my stitches opened up on my hip. So that slowed the whole healing process down of those wounds. So they've actually had to heal from the inside out. And, you know, that's where Chloe and my wife Chloe come into it, you know, packing those wounds every day, rolling out those painful dressing changes pretty much every day. And that just slowed everything down. And that's probably when I hit my low point, when I got home and I was, all that stuff was happening, when it all just sunk in. And yeah, but once I'd got through that and I got to wear my prosthetic for the first time, that's when things started to get a lot better for me mentally.
Yeah.
Being able to walk around and do all that stuff again, yeah, was definitely a big step.
What was the learning curve like to get on a prosthetic leg?
Yeah, it's definitely a slow process, but I think I picked it up pretty quickly. Being young and fit definitely helped me, but it's a very weird sensation, standing there that first time you stand there and all the weight being up under your bum where your prosthetic sits and just not having any sensation of where your foot is. Yeah, it's a strange feeling, but you don't take long. You get used to it.
How long before you were walking around and, getting back to normal?
I think I was walking around after first putting my prosthetic on. I think I was walking around with crutches. Would have been 4 weeks, I reckon, after, which is pretty fast for someone learning to walk on an above-knee prosthetic. Yeah. But I was sort of determined to get going again, get back on the tools and work as a carpenter and, yeah, do all those things I used to before, get back to surfing. Yeah, they were definitely my goals.
Mm. Now, were you married at the time of the attack?
No. I proposed to Chloe 12 months after my attack on one of our favourite beaches on the Eyre Peninsula.
Right.
And since been married and had a little baby boy, so.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, how important was it having someone like Chloe around during all that? I mean, Chloe is sitting right next to him, I should point out, so his answers will be cautious, but I think it was pretty obvious when I saw you too long after the attack when I met both of you that it was, you know, a pretty important relationship for getting you through.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, Chloe took 12 months off work just to care for me, and that was vital in those first few months, and she still does, you know, the amount she does for me, and it definitely makes things easier. But, yeah, she – just little things when we first get home. She was doing all the dressing changes. She was doing all the packing of my wounds. She was helping me get in and out of the shower. And I think we'd moved back to Mum's at this stage in the middle of winter and the bathroom was getting renovated. So we're having to wheel out of the house, upstairs, into a portable bathroom, freezing cold in the Adelaide Hills. Yeah, it wasn't a good time. But, yeah, Chloe helped me through all of that.
When it came time to have a look at going back in the water, what was that like? Was that an important thing for you to do?
Oh, absolutely. And that's probably been the best thing for my mental recovery, I think, is getting back in the water. The biggest challenge was being an above-knee amputee, you don't have that knee joint to be able to, like, to be able to support you. Like, biggest thing in surfing, you're going to be able to bend down and, you know, lower your center of gravity and do all that sort of stuff. And there's no prosthetics on the market for surfing. So I've actually had to come up with my own leg. And I had this idea in my head of creating just a fixed pile onto my prosthetic that creates the same as me standing in a bent position. And I was able to do that with some angle adapters and just virtually aluminium pylons onto a foot. And did a few practices in the backyard just on land. Bit of tweaking here and there, and I think it was pretty much just over 12 months after my attack, I went for my first surf back with a few mates on a really long board and couldn't get up the first few times, but definitely when I was out there, so I knew I was going to get it at some stage, but once once I got up and worked out how to get that back leg up onto the board, then yeah.
So back leg's your...
Yeah, back leg, yeah. So it certainly just slips up and yeah.
If it was the other way around, which is goofy.
Yeah, it'd be really hard to get that around, especially because you can't bend it. It's sort of, it would get caught on things trying to get it around.
You'd have to swap.
Yeah.
You'd have to swap around.
But I think there's guys that do it. Yeah. I mean, there's not many above knee amputee surfers. There's plenty of below knees, but yeah, I think there's a guy that does it in France somewhere that I've seen. Mm.
You're listening to Real Risk, the adventure podcast with Richard Harris.
Where did you go for your first surf?
Just sitting down the south coast, Middleton, where I pretty much learnt to surf.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was just a standard, you know, Middleton day, 2-3 foot, very long paddle out the back. Good fun, you know. And Nick and Nick wasn't there, but Brock, who one of the guys that pulled me from the water, come out. That was his first surf back with me and a couple other mates. So, yeah, that was definitely a big step in my recovery.
Was that pretty emotional back on the beach after that? Or
I think Chloe was. I was just more happy that I was back and I was able to give it a crack. And just that first feeling after standing up and knowing that I could do it, it's just instantly, yeah, I sort of lost that passion for surfing a little bit in that 12 months. I've always followed the surfing around the world and WSL, and I couldn't even go watch mate surf because I just knew how much it'd affect me. And once I went back for that first time and I was able to get up and surf, then, yeah, I was hooked again. And, yeah, I do it a little bit differently, but I'm still able to get up on a board. So
I suspect you're still better than I was at my at my peak. And what about back to work? Because working as a carpenter and a builder, obviously there's a bit of work at heights and things.
So, I'm pretty lucky that prosthetics these days have come a long way. And if it wasn't for the microprocessor knee that I have, that reacts to my movements and what I'm doing and knows if I'm tripping or all those sorts of things. If I didn't have that, then I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing. But that's another thing. I love building, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to do it, but I still managed to do it, and that's mainly because of the prosthetics.
Mm. So you go up a ladder and all that sort of thing?
Still go up a ladder, get up on the roof, get an inner roof, those things. Right. It's probably a little bit harder on my body, but and I know I probably won't be able to do it forever, but, I still enjoy it.
Do you remember having any strong views about sharks before the attack?
Not really. We always used to talk about living on the Eyre Peninsula, with how sharky it is, we always used to talk about it, but I've never been, you know, I've sort of sat in the middle with it a little bit, but I do believe there are more big sharks around, like mainly great whites. There's no doubt about that. We're seeing a lot more of them around Port Lincoln. I don't have hatred towards sharks or anything like that. I just sort of sit in the middle a little bit with it. But
do you feel like this has changed your attitude at all?
Oh, it has a little bit. I'm very wary of where I surf now. Yeah. I don't just go surfing anywhere. But hasn't changed my opinion too much.
No. Okay. You haven't turned into a shark conservationist?
No, I haven't. I mean, I don't want to go out and kill all sharks and do anything like that. I do think if there's a dangerous shark in the area and it's, you know, causing issues, then maybe, yeah, that shark should be taken care of or whatever. I think I just can't get my head around either how there's no decent shark deterrent to this day in the market. I think that's something we need to look into a bit more. But yeah, I don't generally go too much into that sort of thing about sharks. I try to sit in the middle a little bit with that.
Yeah, just get on with your life and get out on the water and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. What else has changed since all of this? You're doing a little bit of speaking. I was lucky enough to hear you speak, or you very kindly came with Chloe to MedStar to speak to us, the staff there. Was that about a year or two?
After my attack. So I have, started to go around and talk to a few schools and stuff like that. I think I do enjoy sharing my story, and if it can help anyone in any way, then that's the reason I do it. I don't, those things that you take for granted, definitely before my attack, I definitely don't do that anymore. And yeah, just all those little things, that's the reason I go and talk, and hopefully people can get something out of it.
I mentioned to you before we chatted that a friend of mine, Heath Jamison, who was good enough to star in one of the earlier episodes of Real Risk, the commando sniper who was shot through the neck, and Heath often talks about the fact that this terrible event, that moment in his life turned out to perhaps be one of the best things that has happened to him, which is a pretty twisted way to look at things in a way, such a dreadful thing that very nearly claimed his life and caused him a great deal of pain and suffering over the next year or two and continues to affect him. But he's kind of put this spin on it that in those moments of fear and close to death, you know, he discovered a lot about himself and his friendships and so forth that he says he wouldn't actually, you know, turn back the clock and change anything.
Yeah.
What's your view on the whole event? Has it been?
I mean, it's definitely made, yeah, like I said, it's definitely helped me in ways. I think I've become a better person after it, haven't I? I've don't take those things for granted. And I think that's been the same for everyone. Like everyone's been through a lot of trauma after my attack or because of my attack. And I think even though they've been through those things, it's sort of helped them in a way look at things a little bit differently and become a better person.
You know, looking back at that day and with your friends close by, there must be a mixture of a sense of guilt of having put them through, you know, what they had to deal with that day, and also gratitude, obviously, for them being, you know, a huge part of saving your life. But then again, I'm sure you'd also know that if the shoe was on the other foot,
yeah, I'd like to think I'd do the same thing. Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was the book that I understand you're working on. Tell us about that.
It's been in the works for the past 4 years. It's been a long process, but Michelle Kress and myself have co-authored in a book about my attack and what happened that day. And it's not really your typical survival. It is about me and it's about my survival, but it's not your typical survivor story. It's about everyone that day, how that trauma's affected them and how it's helped them grow also.
Michelle is the GP.
Yeah, she was the first, what would you call it, the doctor on call when I arrived at Port Lincoln Hospital, and she virtually made all those decisions, those vital decisions that saved my life. So she obviously thought there's definitely a story there to be told. So that's what we've been working on for the past 4 years. And it's coming out this December, and we're having a book launch in Port Lincoln on the 5th of December, and then the following week in Adelaide at Part 4 in Bowdoin on the 10th of December.
And if I'm not mistaken, Chris, that is just before Christmas.
It is, yeah. It's a good Christmas present.
Opportunity out there, and the book is called Caught Inside.
Yep, Caught Inside. So that's a surfing term, but also you'd look at it any way you want. I mean, caught inside the shark's jaws but it's typically that's a surfing term, being caught inside.
And is that going to be available in the bookshops?
Yep, it should be available hopefully in the bookshops, and we're going to have a website and you'll be able to purchase it online.
Excellent. Good. What was the motivation to write the book, apart from being a millionaire one day?
No, definitely not. I think there's definitely the story there to be told, and hopefully my story can help other people that read it. And I want it to be about, you know, those people that lose. The best thing for my recovery was connecting with other amputees and other people that have been through the same thing. So I've got a lot of that stuff in there about my recovery and the phantom pain and all that sort of stuff that was unknown. Lost my leg, and more information the better when you have that. For that, and to get to have this book behind me and hopefully do a little bit more speaking, and yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I want to finish with a little quote that I found on the internet, said by a very smart lady called Chloe Lowes. And she said the success of this rescue was, inverted commas, a relay where the baton was never dropped. And from what I understand about the whole operation from the moment you're attacked to your mates helping you to shore and then everyone up the cliff, guys in the car, the ambos, the paramedics, the medical and nursing staff at the hospital, including all the police who are probably doing CPR and squeezing bags of blood, and as I know they all do in the country and muck in, and then the ambulance service who got you over to Adelaide, and then everyone involved at the Royal Adelaide. It seems like all the ducks really lined up on that day.
Oh, for absolutely! You. There's so many different points where I could have, if this one different decision was made, that would have been it. You know, the leg rope, the extra paramedic, all those little things. Kylie's decision to send the helicopter, which, like you said, you wouldn't normally do for someone that's under CPR from blood loss.
Yeah.
Just all those little things that the baton was never dropped, yeah.
And the love of a good woman.
That's it, yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. It's been a huge pleasure to chat to you, and all the best with the book. I'll be racing out to grab a copy.
Thanks.
That's it for this episode of Real Risk. If you're a risk taker or know someone who'd be good for the show, please send me an email on admin@speleopix.com.au. I'd love to hear from you. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Subscribe, give me a rating, but most importantly, join me for the next one. We'll see you again on Real Risk.